Setlist in association with 7Digital.
This week, the distribution revolution, Lizzo and X-Wars. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
It's been a few weeks since the last set list again, so this edition is going to look back through the last few weeks in the music business.
Yeah, sorry for the absence. Basically, pretty much every day for the last month, I've been on a stage somewhere talking about copyright, because you know I like to talk about copyright. I say a stage, not always a stage. Sometimes a floor, because our seminar rooms don't have stages. But yesterday I had a stage. Twice I had a stage yesterday.
No need to boast.
Talking about, well, partly about copyright and partly about music distribution. The other reason why I've been super busy in recent weeks, we have a brand new report to share with everybody. It launched yesterday as we record this, and we're going to talk about it in a minute.
Yeah, so you know, I normally say we're not here to talk about that this week.
We are here
we
to
are.
Talk about
we absolutely
that
are.
This week.
So stop talking about it.
But yesterday, during all of my copyright chatter, two people came up to me to ask when the next edition of Setlist was coming out, which made me feel quite bad.
Yeah, so should feel bad. It is your fault.
One of them said that if we could get back into a weekly distribution like we were for the first half of this year, that would be a great Christmas present.
It would, wouldn't it?
Which got me thinking, if we managed to do that, can that be all of my Christmas presents? Can all of my family and friends, can I say, there's your Christmas present. Setlist was every week in December.
You can try.
Maybe that's what I'll do.
And then maybe turn away before you see the looks on their faces. But yeah, getting back into a weekly release schedule is our aim in life.
It's on the to-do list.
And let's, by Christmas.
I can confirm I've installed a to-do list app on my phone.
Oh, good. Well, that sorted that then.
And the first thing on it is find the time to do set list on a weekly basis. I'll cancel everything else.
Good.
Everything else in the diary. Anybody who's coming to a conference where I'm talking at, or if I've got a meeting with you, will cancel it so that I can be here to do set list.
Yes. Speaking of cancelling things, the people who've been paying attention to the CMU Daily may have noticed that we promised an episode recently where we would discuss Lizzo's lawsuit and Pledge Music's demise and Kurt Cobain's cardigan.
Yeah, we did promise there was going to be a whole set list edition covering those three topics. We've discussed before whether or not any of our setlist listeners actually properly read the CMU Daily. Well, is there a crossover in the Venn diagram?
There might be.
There should be.
I hope there isn't. But there might be.
Well, if there isn't, then we shouldn't have brought this up and make ourselves look more incompetent than, as incompetent as we are, I guess.
It's not me. I've done everything I need to.
But yeah, we were going to talk about Pledge Music. Obviously, that update, that was a bit depressing anyway, wasn't it? You're going to be talking about that on set list. We had confirmation from the official receiver that basically the Pledge Music company that collapsed earlier this year has no assets to sell in order to raise money to pay back all the artists who were still owed money when Pledge went out of business. It went offline at the start of the year, didn't it, before actually going into liquidation. So that was a little update last month on that, but too depressing really to dwell on in any great detail.
Yeah, there's your journalism hat on there. Oh, I don't even talk about it. Ugh. The Kurt Cobain story, that's less depressing.
Well, kind of depressing, but for totally different reasons.
Well, you know, everyone likes a haunted cardigan. it was for sale.
Yes.
And it did sell.
So this was the cardigan that Kurt Cobain wore in their famous MTV Unplugged thing.
Yeah, you say that like you're unsure, but yes.
And it has been sold various times. And the guy who had owned it for a number of years said he couldn't cope with the responsibility, almost suggesting that there was some sort of power exuding out of the cardigan that was affecting him. So he was selling it, but I mean,
he added a lot of mystique to it.
He did, and in doing so,
he made a lot of money selling it.
So it ended up going for how much?
$334,000.
That's ridiculous for a cardigan, isn't it?
Yeah.
Couldn't all the rock stars of the world all sell a cardigan to raise some money to pay back those more grassroots artists who lost cash on Pledge? Maybe that's something we could organise.
I think you have to die first.
Oh, you have to be dead rock stars.
Yes.
Okay, well, could some rock stars die, leave a cardigan available, and then we'll organise an auction and raise some money?
Okay.
There's something that could distract us from getting set lists back into a weekly cycle.
Yes. But if you want to go deeper into those stories, we'll add links to them on the show notes for this episode.
Although, if you are sitting in the Venn diagram, the middle of the Venn diagram of avid daily reader, avid setlist listener, then you already know all about those stories because you read them in the CMU Daily.
Yes.
But maybe you're just in one side of that Venn diagram, in which case you need the link.
But yeah, that is not what we're here to talk about this week.
Apart from the thing that we are here to talk about this week.
Yes.
But not the not things we're not here to talk about this week.
Yes, because this week we are going to discuss Lizzo's lawsuit and the big X Factor battle between other shows and X Factor and contestants on X Factor and the other show.
And former
winners. And possibly another show.
Of X Factor.
Which may or may not have been made.
All to do
That's
with...
That's all clear. I don't think we need to talk about that now. But first... we are going to discuss, hey, that report you wrote about stuff.
Andy Malt, as always, doing a good hype man job at introducing the important research work that we have been involved in contributing to the conversation in the global music industry.
You say important.
So,
you need to convince me.
Well, here we go. I'm going to convince
you. Go on, I'm going to be an aggressive interviewer.
You're going to be wowed by
Chris,
this.
Chris, why have you done this?
Why have we done this? So this is a new piece of research that we've done at CMU Insights for the Association of Independent Music, and AIM published this report called Distribution Revolution last week. And a little bit of background, given you've just demanded.
Yes, well, I think it's about time, and I wish you'd stop skirting the issue.
Before we even get onto this report, it is interesting... this is interesting. A couple of years ago, you know how at CMU we're being pitched music startup businesses pretty much every week?
Yes.
There's always some music startup being pitched to us by a PR person that is going to be revolutionary, groundbreaking, game-changing, and it's going to rescue the music industry.
And possibly involves the blockchain. I mean, usually involves the blockchain.
It sometimes
in some way that it's impossible to work out.
The blockchain. Yet to quite work out what it is that the music industry needs rescuing from. But hey, there's been a lot of startups waiting to do that task. And I remember a couple of years ago, there was a startup being pitched to me. It was kind of in the world of distribution, but it was being pitched as being new, etc. And I was sitting down with the PR, and I was sort of like, I don't quite understand what it is that your company's doing and how it's different to what that company's doing. And is it like what that company's doing? And well, the conclusion of that conversation was, it's like, oh, you know what? The whole distribution sector is getting really confusing because there's lots of different companies that sort of do the same thing, but then they do different things and some do this and some do that. I would love to have an opportunity to sort of go through all of that, talk to the people that do it, and then draw a nice little diagram that sort of sets it all out as to, okay, we can categorize the companies in this way. This is what they're doing. This is how they differ, etc. So that was a couple of years ago. And about 6 months after that, I got a phone call from Paul Pacifico, who is the CEO of the Association of Independent Music, who said that they had decided that they wanted to put the spotlight on the music distribution sector and to do a big piece of research, talking to distributors, but also talking to the AIM community. So that's obviously independent labels, large labels, small labels, really small labels, and of course, lots of single artist labels, artists who in essence are self-releasing their own music, and to have a look at how the role of the music distributor has changed over the last 20 years, because it's changed a lot.
Mm.
And then look at the different kinds of distributors that are out there today, the different options available to artists and labels who want to get their music specifically digitally released out there on the streaming platforms, the different decisions that people have to make, the questions they should be asking, to in essence provide a benchmark of the sector and then a guide to labels and artists, what we call rights holders in the report, as to how they might go about picking distribution partners and get the most out of that partnership. And so that kickstarted the 18 months of research that we've been doing on this. And I mean, in those 18 months, there has been evolution. At one point, when I had just about got the first draft together, it looked like Spotify was going to become a distributor. And it was like, well, hang on a second, this needs a whole new chapter. And then I remember we had a little focus group at Reeperbahn last year, not this year's Reeperbahn, last year, which was not long after Spotify had announced that it was going to start doing direct uploading. And I was there and Paul was there and we had a few indie labels represented as part of that conversation. And between me and Paul, I think we came up with about 19 reasons why Spotify moving into distribution was a bad idea, which I think we then subsequently discussed some of those on Setlist, didn't we, when we were reporting on that story. And of course, within a year, Spotify had announced that they were not going to go into distribution, that they were
largely for the reasons we said.
Well, we don't know that officially, but we suspect for the reasons that we said. So all of that came together to the report Distribution Revolution that AIM published last week, and it's free, so you can download a free copy off the AIM website. If you go to the AIM homepage, at the moment it's there, just click on it, it'll take you through to a page that tells you a little bit more about the report, and then you can download your free copy as a PDF. We'll also put a link in the setlist notes, I am sure.
Oh yeah.
But I would say that the two big changes that have occurred in music distribution over the last 20 years, which is what a big chunk of the report looks at, is first of all the range of services that are distributed will offer has been slowly but surely increasing. So obviously, it's worth acknowledging, although this report is looking at digital distribution, the idea of there being companies that help independent record companies get their music to market, I mean, that's not a digital innovation. Independent distribution has existed pretty much as long as the record industry has existed. Mm-hmm. Because if you were an independent record company putting out albums on CD or vinyl or cassette or whatever, I mean, getting them into record shops on the high street was a lot of work.
Yeah.
And whereas the major record companies would build their own infrastructure, systems, logistical networks, etc., to get physical products in the shops, most independent labels simply could not afford to do that. And so either they might actually look to use the major labels' infrastructure, because the majors usually would allow indies to do that, because I guess once you've built that infrastructure, you might as well make more money by allowing other people to use it. But of course, there were also a number of independent distribution companies who helped record companies to get their CDs, etc., onto the high street. So distribution isn't new. It is interesting if you look at the history of digital distribution, which, I mean, began pretty much as soon as digital music began. So in the late 90s, the early digital distributors were not the physical distributors adding a digital division. They were startup businesses, because it became quite apparent quite early on that as the first legit digital music platforms started to launch that wanted to license music, they wanted to do it legally, that those platforms, and this will be as true for Apple and iTunes, and then subsequently MySpace tried to do music stuff, and subsequently Google and YouTube, all those digital services had a policy which was, we want to get as much content as possible by doing as few deals as possible.
Yeah.
Which obviously gave the majors an advantage, because the majors could come to the table with much bigger catalogues of music. And so quite early on, we had a bunch of startups who recognised there was an opportunity to basically aggregate the catalogues of indie labels, then go to Apple and say, okay, you should do a deal with us, because look at all the music we're representing, and we can make it easier for you to get lots of music through a single transaction. So we had the emergence of the original digital distributors, which were separate companies to the physical distributors, although they were kind of doing the digital equivalent of what the physical distributors were doing. Subsequently, after that, those startups started to grow. A lot of the physical distributors did then move into digital distribution, recognizing that's where the record industry was heading. The majors went full on into digital distribution and have really grown that size of their businesses over the last 10 years, Sony in particular, through the Orchard. And then subsequently, a bunch of new startups, often very well financed startups, entered the market. And so we got to the point where there was lots and lots of people offering digital distribution of one form or another. And initially, the key service all those companies were offering was, in essence, this aggregation, that we aggregate the catalogues of all these different labels, then we go and negotiate deals, because it's hard negotiating deals with the digital platforms. And once we shifted into streaming, it was even harder, because the deals just got more and more complicated. And also, even once you've done the deal, you then need to get the content into the services. And I think it's tempting, isn't it, to assume, well, surely that bit's easy. Yeah, getting a CD into a record shop, understand why that's quite hard work. But I mean, uploading a WAV file, how hard can that be? But actually, that digital delivery process isn't just as simple as uploading a WAV file. All the services have their own specifications of how you provide the content, whether that's audio or the accompanying visuals or the metadata. And so each service will say, we need it very specifically like this. And then, just to add extra complexity, each service has different specifications. So one will say, oh, we want it like this, one will say it like that. And in the late 2000s, when iTunes was so dominant, it was kind of like, well, Apple rules were the rules, because whatever iTunes decided. I remember there was a period back then. Well, do you remember when the requirements for images kept increasing?
Yeah.
So it was like 500 pixels. And so, oh, no, actually, now we need all your photos at 1,500 pixels. Oh, no, now we need them at 3,000 pixels, just because screen resolutions were increasing.
Yeah.
And that was very much led by Apple, which is a major pain for the labels and distributors, because it meant they had to resupply all the artwork, and often they didn't have the original files. Anyway, the point is that delivering the content is not quite as simple as it sounds. It requires building a platform, and actually, you know, for most smaller labels, and certainly self-releasing artists, they could never afford to build that platform. So that's what distributors were doing. They were negotiating deals with the download stores and streaming services. They were building platforms to deliver the content, and then also platforms to process all the data and the money that comes back. And that's the core role of the distributor on the, well, in the report we call the aggregation side.
Yeah.
But as I say, the trend over the last 15 years is, as well as doing that core aggregation, distributors now offer lots of other services to their clients. So the obvious extension was, as digital music evolved, new tasks came up. The obvious one is playlist pitching. So as playlists started to become more important in driving streams, particularly for new music on a Spotify or whatever, it's like, okay, we now need to start pitching pitching to these playlisters, and for a lot of smaller rights holders, it was kind of an obvious thing to say to their distributor as well. You manage our relationship with Spotify, maybe you should be pitching to the playlisters. And so most of the distributors start adding that as an add-on service. But actually, the add-on services go way beyond playlist pitching and things like that, so that some distributors now get very involved in all the marketing around the release. So advertising and the email activity and pitching to press and to radio, etc., etc. Plus, distributors are offering all sorts of other services as well, like managing your YouTube channel, managing your catalogue, doing royalty admin so you can report what royalties are due to your artists, things like neighbouring rights or performing rights. So getting involved in logging recordings with the collecting societies and then processing the money that comes in from radio stations and pubs, clubs, bars, cafes through the collective licensing system, all of that sort of stuff. And so you've kind of got to the point now where as a label, with some distributors, you could go to that company and take all of the services they offer, which pretty much leaves very little left for the label to do. Basically A&R. So you could now have a scenario where the label is just an A&R outfit. They're just involved in signing artists, sending them into the studios, overseeing the creative process, artistic development. So that's what the label does. And then everything else involved in releasing the record, marketing the record, distributing the record, administrating the rights, you could outsource, if you wanted to your distributor.
So that's quite a big shift within the record industry in terms of who's responsible for which bits of it. So when you spoke to these different companies, did they give any indication of why that transfer has happened?
Yeah, it was interesting when I was talking both to labels and distributors and saying, oh, it's interesting, all these extra services have been added. Why do you think that has happened? Because when you spoke to the distributors, they tended to say, well, we keep adding all of these services because our clients keep asking for them. So the labels keep saying, well, could you do this? Could you do this? But when we spoke to the labels and said, well, why do you think the number of services a distributor might offer has increased? They were like, well, they keep offering us these services. And every time we come up for a deal negotiation, they're like, oh, we could do this, we could do this, we could do this. So each side was saying the other side was leading on this. I think there are probably various reasons why the list of services have increased. But one reason is, I mentioned just now how as digital distribution has evolved, it has become very competitive because we had the original startups and the physical distributors started doing digital and the majors went full on to this. And then we had some other startups entering the market. And with a competitive market, obviously, inevitably, prices are going to start to go down because those who are aggressively competing, particularly sort of the startups that have lots of cash to spend on growing their market share, or maybe the majors who've decided this is a priority, will start undercutting their competitors. So the rates a distributor charges, and often a distributor ultimately is on some sort of commission or rev share arrangement where they take a cut of the money that comes through once the digital music is being streamed or downloaded or whatever. And those commissions start to come down. And in the short term, if you are a label or an artist, that's a good thing. You're showing less of the money. Although you could say in the long term, actually is a result of that, that some of the smaller players have to merge or sell, or maybe they even go out of business. So ultimately, we end up with less choice in the market, and maybe that's a bad thing. But you can see why, in the short term, as a label or an artist, if somebody would traditionally want 30% to do your distribution, and then a new company enters the market and says, well, we'll do it for 25%, and then someone else says, well, we'll do it for 20%, in the short term, that seems like a good thing. But I think some of the distributors who didn't want to compete on price, often for sensible reasons, were like, well, what else can we do? And it was like, well, what if we said to our client, okay, we can't compete with that new rival on the commission levels, but we could do your playlist pitching as well, and then we'll stay at 30%. It's like, oh, maybe we could also do some other social activity for you and keep us at 30%. Or I suppose in the case of things like neighbouring rights, it's like, well, maybe if we get involved in another revenue stream, then we can take a cut of that as well. So if we're having to take slightly less of the streaming revenue stream, but then we can take a little bit of the neighbouring rights revenue stream, then we can make it work. So I think that probably was one of the reasons why the number of services has increased. As I say, the thing that generally isn't on the menu from a distributor is A&R. And obviously, it's worth acknowledging there are plenty of labels out there who don't take all of these services, you know, who are keeping the marketing and the admin, and then they are literally just using their distributor for getting their content onto the streaming services. And indeed, you know, there are some indies that don't need their distributor for a deal. They either have negotiated their own deal, or more likely they're relying on a Merlin deal. And we've talked about Merlin before on Setlist, which negotiates sort of template deals for the wider indie community. But they still usually need someone to help deliver the content. So there are some indies who all they are buying from a distributor is just the content delivery bit. So a company like Fuga and CI will offer that as a standalone service. But yeah, there are some labels buying in everything but A&R, except what we discovered was when we were talking to the distributors is a couple of the distributors I spoke to were like, well, actually, we're now starting to offer some A&R type services in there as well. And I suppose that brings us to the second big trend in distribution over the last 10, 15 years. And that's very sort of linked into all of this, which is not only has the range of services increased, so has the range of clients. In that, traditionally, for example, in the physical era, distributors predominantly worked for labels. So an artist would sign to a label, and then if the label was not able to build its own infrastructure, it would then use a distributor, and maybe it would get other services from that distributor. But of course, what has happened more recently is we're starting to see artists working directly with distributors, either because they're grassroots DIY artists at the very start of their career, and they're not yet established enough that a label would want to work with them, but they want to get their content onto the streaming services, so they use what I call a DIY distributor. So companies that offer those sorts of services, I mean, the CD Baby, TuneCore, DistroKid, Ditto, Emu Bands, etc., etc., etc. But of course, we're starting to see more established artists also working directly with distributors instead of a label, basically by becoming a label.
Yeah.
Setting up a label, usually in partnership with either management or maybe with a studio and a producer. And then, because they are now a label, looking to then get a distributor to, in essence, do. And I guess it's those sorts of labels, single artist labels, where taking all of the services makes the most sense.
Yeah.
Because the artist doesn't want to be doing any of the other work. But it does create an interesting dilemma, because I think what is happening is the line between distributor and label is starting to blur. Because as the distributor starts to offer more and more services, particularly if they start offering A&R services, and you get to a point where it's like, well, how are you different to a label? The deal structure is different. Although, obviously, the more services a distributor offers, the higher commission they're going to be charging, till you get to the point where, well, now there is more parity between what a label would want to take and what a distributor would want to take. Not completely, but we're getting in that direction. So that's another interesting thing we talk about in the report, the blurring of the lines between labels and distributors, which creates an interesting dilemma, which we talk about, which is, if you're an independent label, you're working with a distributor, and they're doing nearly all of the work, plus, of course, they're seeing all of your artist data, because all the streaming data passes through them before it comes to you, but they are now working directly with artists, offering the same services. It's like, well, now your trusted partner is also potentially a competitor, because what's to stop that distributor down the line from looking to work with the artist directly and cutting you out of the equation? And we're not saying that happens that often, but it's certainly something to think about. And the whole data thing, the fact that your distributor sees all of the data about your artists, and that data is really valuable. So that's another thing we talk about in the report, is being really clear, well, who is getting that data? What do they get to do with it? Some distributors actually outsource some of the distribution to other distributors. So sometimes the artist signs to a label who uses a distributor, who uses a distributor, who uses a distributor, who gets the content to Spotify. And the data will pass along all of those companies' platforms. And that's another thing we talk about in the report, is being really clear when you pick a distributing partner, how is the data flowing, who will see the data? Because some of those entities in the chain are potentially competitors. And even if we're not saying they're going to overtly try and screw you over and steal your artists, it's just being aware that other competing companies are getting access to your data. So that's a very quick summary of what's in the report. It is free. You can download it. The first bit is kind of a history of digital distribution. Then we talk about these trends, the expansion of services and the expansion of clients. Then we go through, if you are looking for a distribution partner, these are the things you probably want to negotiate on. These are the questions you want to be asking. And then at the end, we talk about some of the challenges, and what AIM are now going to do is take that report, look at those challenges, continue the conversation, and they'll have some other initiatives coming up in the next year or so around all of this.
So yeah, go and download that. If you go to aim.org.uk, you will find the information there on how to download this report for free. And as we say, we will add a link to help you out with that on the show notes for this episode. We could just Google it. There's lots of ways to find things on the internet. We should do a report on that.
So rather than being disparaging of me and my report, you've decided to be disparaging of our listeners and their internet skills.
Yeah.
You've got to be disparaging about something, I guess.
Yeah. Still to come on this week's episode, we have the big X Factor and Little Mix showdown. But now, there have been a number of interesting copyright cases in recent weeks, including the latest development in the Taylor Swift Shake It Off lyrics dispute and the ruling in Sony and Warner's case against the radio app TuneIn. You can read about both of those on the CMU website, or I'll link to it on the show notes, or you could Google it. But we promised at the top of the show we were going to talk about this Lizzo case, and so that is what we're going to do. Lizzo has recently launched a lawsuit against two producers who are attempting to claim co-writer credits on her hit single, Truth Hurts. Justin and Jeremiah Raisin say that they worked on an earlier song that contained the key lyric of Truth Hurts, or the opening line, "I just took a DNA test, turns out I'm 100% that bitch." That is the line. I'm not telling you that about me. I mean, it should be inferred. It's actually quite a hotly contested line. There's been various disputes about it, including this one. And now it's all gone legal.
Yes, so we started reporting on this story last month, which is when it properly started to go legal. Although it has to be said that the dispute had been happening prior to that on the good old social networks. And for reasons I can't quite understand, we didn't really report on any of that, did we?
No.
We're not interested in people making bold copyright claims on Instagram.
No.
That's not a forum for making claims of ownership of copyright.
Courts or nothing.
But this has been unfolding on the social networks for a while, but the reason why we are now talking about it is because we have it in a proper forum.
Mm.
There is now legal papers. Litigation has been filed. And so that's what we're talking about here today. But I suppose, I mean, maybe it's worth quickly recapping what did happen on the social networks before we had the lawsuits. So before these two producers even got involved, there was a little bit of a dispute earlier in the year on the socials because once this track, well, I suppose we should first of all point out, this isn't a new track.
No.
This track has been around for over 2 years now, but it became a hit this year. It wasn't a hit 2 years ago when it was released. It became a hit this year for various reasons. I mean, first of all, this has been Lizzo's year.
Yes.
So after plodding away for quite some time, that third album she released has really, her career has exploded.
I don't think Lizzo has ever plodded. But, sorry.
Persevered.
Uh-huh.
Worked hard.
Yeah.
I'm saying she's worked hard on her musical output. But the good news is for her that this is the year where certainly her audience has gone much more mainstream. And so therefore there is renewed interest in some of her older output. And then this particular track got a bit of traction going over on TikTok. And then it was synced into a buzzy Netflix film earlier in the year. So various reasons why this track is suddenly back in the news. It went to the top of the Billboard Hot 100.
Certainly did.
On the back of all of that. But very recently. And as this track started to get more talked about online, the initial spat on the socials was that there was a British artist who claimed that this standout lyric at the start of Truth Hurts was a direct quote of something that she had tweeted several months before the song was even written back in 2017.
Mm. Yes, so her name is Mina Lioness. And yes, she said early 2017, she tweeted this line. What it subs, well, certainly Lizzo's story now, and I see no reason not to believe it, but is that that tweet was turned into a meme. Lizzo saw that meme while she was writing the song, thought, I like that, and then used that line in this initial song that had it in and subsequently in Truth Hurts. And she had no idea about this original tweet until later when Mina Lioness came forward and went, that is my line. Why are you using it?
Yeah, so initially Lizzo responded on social media and was saying, I'd never seen your tweet. I was just aware that there was an Instagram meme based on your tweet. That's what influenced my song. And then it kind of went quiet. And then this British artist discovered that Lizzo, I think in the US, was trying to trademark the phrase 100% that bitch.
Yeah.
Then Mina Lioness went back to social media to sort of say, well, that's a bit sneaky.
Mm.
You know, you nicked my tweet for your lyric and now you're trying to trademark that and turn it into a brand and so on and so forth. Actually, as far as we're aware, we've not had an official statement on this, but there has been a Lizzo post on Instagram, and it kind of alluded to it in the lawsuit we're about to talk about. It seems that that particular dispute has been resolved.
Yes.
And this Mina Lioness has actually been given a co-writing credit on Truth Hurt for her tweet that became a lyric. And you assume as soon as you get a credit, that also means you're being cut into the copyright and therefore the money. Although we don't know that. We just know that there has been a truce between those two parties. But that then brings us to the main dispute with these two producers.
Justin and Jeremiah Raisin.
So it's not denied that Lizzo has collaborated with these two guys in the past. And as they have claimed, initially through an Instagram post.
Yes.
Once this track had become a chart-topping hit. It is true that Lizzo did some recording sessions at a studio owned by these two producers, and that one of the songs that she came up with during those sessions was called Healthy. This is the demo track that's alluded to by these producers, and that track, Healthy, started with the same line, which then was then reworked, came the first line in Truth Hurts.
Yeah.
So the fact that there was this original song from which that lyric was then taken for Truth Hurts, the fact that that song was written and recorded at the studio owned by these two producers. That's not denied.
No.
Everybody can agree on that. But the dispute is over what role those two producers had in the writing of that original song, and whether or not their involvement in that song or not gives them a claim to ownership of the copyright in Truth Hurts Itself, or a slice of the copyright in Truth Hurts Itself. And before we get to the lawsuit, they took to Instagram in the early part of October and basically said, we are co-writers on Truth Hurts because we were co-writers on this earlier work from which that lyric came, and we should be due a slice of the copyright and the money. We've been asking for this for 2 years now. They just keep ignoring our requests. So we felt that the only way to resolve this was to go public. And then that obviously got quite a lot of press coverage.
Mm. Yes, so they argued that they were the co-writers of this song, Healthy, and given that the standout lyric from that song was then copied into Truth Hurt, they should then have a co-write credit on the newer track that was actually released. They also, in that post, tried to align themselves with Me and a Lioness, saying that if they won what they believe was their fair share, they would also share some money with her because she was being screwed over by Lizzo as far as like they were, how they were presenting it. Although Lizzo has then clawed back the higher ground in that side of the conversation latterly.
Yeah, so all of this resulted in the lawsuit being filed by Lizzo and her team, which is why we are talking about it here today. And in that, with regards these two producers who are brothers, I suppose there are two main things that Lizzo is saying in her lawsuit. First, that, okay, yes, maybe this original song was written in their studio and maybe the key lyric from that song became the key lyric in Truth Hurts. But just because it happened in their studio doesn't mean they were involved in writing even the original song, let alone Truth Hurts Itself.
Mm.
So basically saying they were just around, but that it was Lizzo and another producer called Ricky Reed who were actually actively in the studio writing at that time, talking about this Instagram meme and then making the lyric on the back of it. So she's basically saying they weren't co-writers on this original track. So therefore, even if we were to say that Truth Hurts did, in essence, sample some of the demo, they weren't involved in the demo track. So therefore, they have no claim to share in the copyright in Truth Hurts. But I think probably secondly and more importantly in the Lizzo lawsuit, she goes to great lengths to explain that not only does she think that the Raisin Brothers shouldn't have a stake in Truth Hurts, until very recently, the Raisin Brothers also thought that they shouldn't have a cut in the copyright in Truth Hurts.
Yeah, so her lawsuit says that this dispute has actually come up before, but was resolved. And she had personally spoken on the phone with, I think, Justin Raisin, and he had admitted, according to her lawsuit, that they hadn't really been involved in the writing of it and would drop their claim to any ownership of the song. That did happen. She says their lawyer called the next day and said they were dropping their claim. Their publisher, Cobalt, confirmed that the claim was being dropped, and it only was reinstated after the track became a hit. In fact, after it went to number one in the US.
Yeah, so the lawsuit sets all this out step by step. I sense that one of the reasons why it came to head earlier this year, before it was marching its way up the Billboard chart, was because of that Netflix sync.
Mm.
Because if you're doing a sync deal, and remember in the US, TV sync can't be licensed through the collective licensing system. You have to do a direct deal. To be honest with you, I don't even know whether a Netflix film counts as TV or film or whatever. But crucially, in order for Netflix to put the track in this film that they were making, they needed to get deals from all of the labels and publishers that had a stake in the track and the song. And obviously, if you're trying to license music to go in a film or a TV program, and there's a dispute over the ownership of that song, well, you don't want to touch it.
Yeah.
Because you don't want to end up thinking you've licensed a song and then someone coming along and saying, actually, you should have got a deal with us too. That's copyright infringement. So I sort of sense that one of the reasons why they were trying to sort all this out earlier in the year was to allow this Netflix sync deal to be done. They got this agreement, as you say, from the Raisin Brothers themselves, from their lawyer, from their publisher, that they definitely weren't making a claim. The Netflix deal was done. And then there was various other correspondence over the summer. So, for example, for reasons that I don't think anyone ever quite worked out, although hindsight it was a bit suspicious, the ASCAP database, obviously ASCAP, one of the American Collecting Societies, database of all of its members' works. One of the other co-writers on Truth Hurts, so not Lizzo herself, I think their manager, happened to notice that the Raisin Brothers had a co-write credit for the song in the ASCAP database.
Mm.
So they then fired off an email, I think, to Cobalt and said, what's this about? And they were like, oh, that's a mistake, we'll fix that. Then a rumour was doing the rounds in August that Justin Raisin had been saying that he still thought that he should have a stake in the song. So again, they emailed, I can't remember whether that was the lawyer or the publisher at that time, but somebody official who said, oh, no, we're not making a claim. And then it was only, as you say, after the track had got to number one in the Billboard charts, that official word came through that the Raisin Brothers had changed their mind and were now pushing for a slice of the action again.
Yes. Now, this lawsuit, it's not only a double Raisin lawsuit, it's also a double Justin lawsuit, because there's a second Justin to be discussed here, Justin Rothman, who produces under the name Eves. He is also apparently making some claim to ownership of the song Truth Hurts, and the lawsuit also deals with him. Basically says he was also kind of around when the song was written, but was also not involved in the writing of the song, but postulates that he's now making a claim because he reckons if the Raisin Brothers can get some money out of this for just being there, then he might as well also.
Yeah, so what the lawsuit says with this other claimant is, whereas with the Raisin Brothers, they had previously made a claim and it was all agreed that they didn't have a claim, and then there was all that correspondence that seemingly confirmed it, assuming we're trusting everything as written in the lawsuit, this is all the claims on that side. What they're saying with the other guy is, for over 2 years, he hasn't even mentioned it.
Yeah.
He never once came forward to suggest that he should have any sort of claim. So yeah, the allegation is he's seeing that maybe, particularly now the Raisin Brothers have gone public, they're going to get a slice of this copyright, they're going to get a payday, they're going to get a chunk of all the money that's been generated by this song. And so he's thinking, oh, well, I was there that day.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll have a cut too. It reminds me of one of the bits of advice that we always give at our CMU DIY events with sort of grassroots artists and songwriters, because we talk a lot about whenever you collaborate, you need to agree who's being cut in to the copyright in both the song and the recording, and in addition to who's cut into the rights, who might be cut into future royalties. And one thing I always say is that whenever you're discussing who's been cut into a song copyright, you do have to involve everybody in the room.
Yeah.
Not just the three people who clearly collaborated on the song, but the five people who are sitting around the edge. Because even though you might think, well, they were just sitting around the edge, tapping away on their social media all day, they may leave thinking they've co-written a song.
Mm.
So you do need to involve everybody in the debate. But in essence, what this lawsuit is saying is, if this guy genuinely believed that he had somehow co-written Truth Hurts, as soon as that song was out and he noticed that it shared a lyric with this song that was made on a day when he was in the Raisin Brothers studios, well, that was his opportunity to step forward. And the fact that he doesn't means that this is just an opportunistic attempt to grab a bit of cash now this song is a hit.
Yes. So Lizzo is seeking court clarification that neither the Raisins nor Rothman are due any stake in Truth Hurts, and for them to cover her legal costs and then any other costs that the court decides maybe she's due, because, you know, you've got to have little room for interpretation there.
Well, I suppose, I mean, and it does reference in the case, as I've already said, I mean, although they'd managed to do that sync deal with Netflix, the minute a song goes into dispute, any ways in which the song might be used that would have to be directly licensed. I mean, if for things like, you know, radio and live performance, it all goes through the collecting societies anyway. So it can stop people getting paid, but it won't necessarily stop the music getting used. But when it comes to full-on sync deals, you can't do the deal. So by putting it back into dispute, potentially Lizzo could lose out on sync deals or whatever.
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of what they were alluding to, a sort of maybe the court would like to give me some damages too.
Now, we said we were not that interested in disputes on Instagram, but Lizzo commented on Instagram shortly after it had been filed in the courts. She said, as I've shared before, in 2017, while working on a demo, I saw a meme that resonated with me, a meme that made me feel like 100% that bitch. I sang that line in the demo, and I later used that line in Truth Hurts. The men who now claim a piece of Truth Hurts did not help me write any part of the song. They had nothing to do with the line or how I chose to sing it. There was no one in the room when I wrote Truth Hurts except me, Ricky Reed, and my tears. The song is my life, and its words are my truth. I later learned that a tweet inspired the meme. The creator of the tweet is the person I'm sharing my success with, not these men. Period.
So it's been a few weeks since this lawsuit was filed now, of course, though as yet we've not had a formal response from the other side. There is a high chance that all the lawyers involved in this are annoyingly discussing behind the scenes for some sort of out-of-court settlement. Who knows? But I'm sure if we do get any more proper legal action, or who knows, maybe some more Instagram spatting on this story, then I'm sure we'll come back to it on a future edition of Setlist.
And finally this week, Simon Cowell has declared war on Little Mix by launching a show a bit like the one that they're about to launch and, you know, trying to get the jump on them because, well, you know, it's that time of year and he needs to promote the new series of X Factor.
Yeah, he's been giving various interviews to various people about all of this. So I suppose for this to make sense, for this entire story to even begin to be logical, you need to know, which if you're an avid CMU Daily reader, you would know because we reported on it.
Yes.
But for those of you in the other half of the Venn diagram, what you need to know is that Little Mix, former X Factor winners, of course, recently announced plans to launch their own TV show, nothing to do with X Factor, no X in the name, not even on ITV.
No.
It's a BBC One show.
Sure, yeah.
And, you know, if you want to be a snob, you could say, as a BBC show rather than an ITV show, that's more prestigious, although we have to acknowledge that pretty much every talent show that the BBC have tried to do that doesn't involve dancing has been a bit of a flop. But Little Mix have teamed up with the BBC to launch a new talent show in which a search will take place for new pop groups of people singing pop songs.
Yeah.
And those pop groups will then compete on this new TV show on the BBC sometime next year. And the winner of the entire contest will get a support slot on the next Little Mix tour. So that is the TV show that was announced about a month ago.
So it's good. It's not like, you know, it's a tangible prize. It's not like you might get, I mean, you won't get famous, but you might. You've the possibility of like spending a few years thinking, oh, this is it now. You're gonna do the show, you're going to support Little Mix on tour, and then you can just go away and never think about this ever again.
But you will always have in your memories the time that you played a large shed in Doncaster,
yeah,
for example, to remember fondly about for the rest of your life. So that's the Little Mix talent show concept. It's going live at some point next year on BBC One. They announced it all a few weeks ago. But Mr. Simon Cowell, who's desperately trying to keep the frickin' X Factor franchise alive here in the UK, is seemingly annoyed by Little Mix, his creation, or the creation of his show, I guess, who obviously used to be released by Cowell's Psycho label. He's pissed off with them going with the other side and launching their own talent show, which has nothing to do with X Factor. And so annoyed is he, or at least he's sufficiently annoyed to get some PR capital out of this, he has brought forward plans for an alternative version of X Factor, which more directly competes with what Little Mix are proposing.
Yes, X Factor The Band, which there were already plans to launch this in autumn next year. He's bringing it forward. He's cancelled the planned series, X Factor All Stars, which was going to be previous winners of the X Factor, who up until now you didn't remember, competing again to win the X Factor again.
Yeah, because basically,
so you could forget them again.
Even, imagine this. Even the average ITV1 viewer is bored of X Factor. That's how far it's got. So Cowell has been trying to reinvigorate interest by doing variations on the theme. So there's a celebrity version, celebrity in inverted commas version, which I think is going out at the moment. Then there was going to be this version involving X finalists from the show. And then there was going to be this specific version focused on forming groups rather than launching the career of solo artists. Although, I mean, X Factor did that anyway. Because when X Factor launched, if you can remember that, back in the early 1870s or whenever it was, and they were trying to distinguish it from the idol shows that it basically ripped off. Obviously, the difference between X Factor and Pop Idol was that Pop Idol was just focused on solo artists. Pop Stars that preceded it was focused on groups. And X Factor's thing was, we're going to do solo stars and groups.
Could be anyone. They just have to have the X Factor.
And of course, along the way, they took solo singer entrants and turned them into group.
Yeah.
So X Factor's, I mean, arguably, well, I guess in One Direction and Little Mix are the two big success stories from X Factor, both of which were group.
Yeah.
But in order to reinvigorate interest in X Factor, the plan was, okay, we'll do the celebrity version, we'll do the former finalist version, and then we'll have a version which is just about groups. But of course, by being just about forming a new pop group, that makes it incredibly similar to this Little Mix series. And there is more of a backstory to Cowell being pissed off about Little Mix series, which has possibly further motivated why he's trying to gazump them by bringing his band show forward.
Yes, so Little Mix are managed by Modest Management. Modest Management used to work very closely with Simon Cowell and X Factor.
Yeah, because I mean, they used to have the deal where they managed the winners,
yeah,
and indeed many of the finalists on the show. They don't anymore, but they used to be the management company that was in cahoots with Psycho on the whole X Factor venture.
Yes, and they fell out last year, so there is beef.
Yes.
Yeah.
Little Mix no longer working with
Psycho. They're not friends anymore. And so that's another reason why he wants to just get in there and ruin their day.
But before that happened, Simon Cowell told The Sun recently, Modest, who are launching a whole new division, a whole new TV side to the business.
Yes, this is their first thing that they're doing with their new TV division.
And according to Cowell, when that plan was first on the cards, they approached him about him becoming a co-producer on the project.
Yeah.
I don't know whether by that point they knew it was going to go to the BBC. Maybe they hadn't picked a network at that point. But Cowell told them, this is before they fell out, I'm sorry, I can't be involved in your new Little Mix, former new pop band format, because we've already got in development our X Factor former group project, and I can't be involved in both.
Yeah.
So sorry, can't be involved in it. And he says that when that project was pitched to him about him getting involved in it, the plan was for the Little Mix show to go out in 2021.
Yeah.
So he was thinking, well, we'll do X Factor, the band, in 2020. But then the BBC put out their press announcement saying, no, the Little Mix show is happening in 2020. He didn't go as far as saying that Modest and the BBC had deliberately moved it forward to gazump him, although he was leaving that as a possibility behind their motivation.
And then I think he was being pretty explicit about moving his show forward to do exactly that to them.
Yes, he wasn't 100% certain about their motivation, but he was pretty clear about his motivation.
Yes, although, I mean, there are other reports that he was struggling to find former finalists willing to take part in the All-Star version, and that's the real reason it's come forward.
Yes, he committed to ITV that there would be a spring version, and then it looked like they were not going to get the finalists won together.
Yes, it seemed that people had been possibly interested, but then had pulled out when the realisation that it would be awful set in. But anyway, whatever happened, he's bringing forward this X Factor the Band thing, and it means he can go out and do lots of interviews and say, whoa, look at us fighting Little Mix, is a big fight.
Hey people, remember there is still this thing called X Factor.
Yes.
And maybe you'd want to watch it.
And this is, I mean, it's a nice spin on the annual X Factor fight story. Usually it's all the judges hate each other. And this year it's Simon Cowell hates former X Factor winners. I mean, they could have come back for the All-Star edition, but no, they're going to do their own show.
They're going to do their own show. Now, not only is there a beef between Simon Cowell and Little Mix and Modest, there's a potential beef between Simon Cowell and his best pal, former best pal, one-time girlfriend, used to be involved in X Factor, 80s pop star Sunita,
yeah,
who then came out of the woodwork and said, hey, Little Mix trying to do their pop group forming talent show, now Simon Cowell trying to do his pop group forming talent show. I was there first with this idea, she said.
Yes, she claims that she came up with this idea and pitched it to Simon Cowell before Modest had come to him with their idea. She filmed a pilot for it a year ago, and the Mirror's report on this suggested that she'd filmed the entire series, which, I mean, unless someone's made a terrible error, I mean, that's not how you make TV shows.
Yes, do a whole series about having a network interested in screening it, although, I mean, maybe she's thinking of setting up a YouTube channel.
Maybe.
Modern.
Yes, that's a possibility. But she was suggesting that, yeah, this was all her idea, and now she'd been cut out of it completely by everyone.
Both Cowell and Little Mix ripping off her totally original, never thought about before idea,
yeah,
of having a telly show that forms a group.
There was, of course, Pop Stars, The Rivals, where One True Voice came out of that, didn't they?
Yes. So I'm sure you all remember.
That was the big act to come out of that.
And that followed Pop Stars, which gave us Hearsay. So
yeah,
the first of the modern incarnation. I mean, obviously things like Opportunity Knocks existed long before this, but the first of the modern incarnation of the pop star creating talent shows were all about pop groups. And then Pop Idol came along, and then X Factor came along. Although, as we said, X Factor had groups in. I think basically what we're saying here is,
if I was fighting over having an idea which was very much had already and had become tired already, and the only way apparently to really revamp it is to have an argument about it.
Makes you think that actually the better TV show would be a TV show involving Little Mix, Cowell and Sunita all trying to get their shows on air.
Yeah.
And then that never actually be a show. It'd just be the competition as to who can get a crappy old idea regurgitated and on mainstream TV.
I mean, that sounds like most TV programming anyway. Yeah, so basically what we're saying is TV is rubbish and no one should watch it.
But for those of you who are still watching TV,
ugh,
for those of you in the Venn diagram of set list listeners, TV, I'm surely if you're a trendy, cool, of the now person who tunes into quality podcasts, you're not still watching shitty live TV. Maybe a Netflix show occasionally, but not something on BBC One or ITV One. But if you are that person, next year you will have the joy of watching X Factor the Band, whatever the Little Mix show is called.
Little Mix the Search.
Little Mix the Search. And then
Sunita the group.
And then imagining what Sunita's show in her brain might have been like. Or who knows, maybe it will appear on...
I mean, I imagine it'll be like X Factor. I mean, it's just going to be like all the other shows where they just... It's not a new idea. It's just stupid. Just say it's X Factor. No one would notice. If you just called it X Factor and put it on, it was just groups, everyone would be like, there's another series of X Factor. Half the people would stop watching it.
So I guess the question here is, will Simon Cowell's desperate attempt to create some intrigue in the latest shitty version of his shitty show pull in the viewers? And maybe it will.
Maybe.
So we will see.
Yeah, but we don't have time to sit around here waiting for that to happen now, because we've come to the end of the show. And that is all we've got time for this week. If you've got any questions or comments about any of the issues raised in this episode, email us, setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook, produced by Matt Peaty. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at unique facilities, Setlist is an Unlimited production.